Linda Jacobson, it was assumed that Australia's first Mandarin-speaking Prime Minister would boost Australia's relationship with China. Did Kevin Rudd achieve that?
I think there were a lot of expectations toward Kevin Rudd, and because he was really the first high-level Western leader who spoke Mandarin, knew China, and I think the expectations were too great. And one can say that relations were not boosted during his time, first as Prime Minister and then as Foreign Minister. I've discussed Foreign Minister Rudd last year with the same foreign policy officials, foreign policy researchers in China, and they were usually quite polite, though I did get the sense that they weren't terribly pleased with him. Now, when he's no longer in government, they started to speak about the Rudd factor, that he had upset them.
Wasn't Kevin Rudd simply speaking plainly to the Chinese about human rights issues that many Australians are concerned about?
Oh, absolutely. But there are many Western leaders who have spoken about human rights issues, about the lack of democracy, lack of rule of law, lack of freedom of expression, and so on in China. And it hasn't quite led to the same result. I think in Kevin Rudd's case, because there were these expectations that he would be able to somehow magically deal with China in a new way because of his fluency in Mandarin, it really came to his persona, his personality. And one can say that, of course, leadership matters, but also personality matters when conducting diplomacy.
We've, of course, heard a lot about Kevin Rudd's personality in recent weeks over the leadership crisis. Are you saying that there were personality issues that he had with the Chinese as well?
I would say probably yes. Certainly the language he used about Chinese at the Copenhagen Climate Summit and the way he talked about China and Chinese to Hillary Clinton, according to the WikiLeaks cables, it's a question of personality, yes. Speaking the language alone is really not enough. There has to be a cultural sensitivity. Certainly the terrible language he used about Chinese at the Copenhagen Climate Summit would upset any country.
So did he actually damage the relationship?
I think damage is much too strong a word. The impression that I very much got in Beijing these past 2 weeks in my conversations with people I've known for years and years is that there's really a sense that we could have a new start, a reset button, so to speak.
So do you think Australia's new foreign minister can repair the relationship?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think coming in as a professional, as someone with a long record of understanding international affairs, Bob Carr really does have a chance to start afresh. He's known for his staunch support and belief in the Australia-US alliance. This is something China acknowledges in any case, but at the same time, Australia is very dependent economically on China and needs to, at least in my view, broaden, deepen that relationship with China. Because China is not an ally, on the contrary, there are many, many values issues. For example, the human rights issues, but other issues too to do with values. It doesn't mean that one shouldn't try and engage with the Chinese government across the board. China is no longer a country which speaks with only one voice. China has many interest groups who are all part of the decision-making processes. And I think Bob Carr will set out to deepen and broaden that relationship.
How are Chinese leaders and diplomats and the others that you mentioned likely to have viewed Minister Carr's maiden speech in Parliament yesterday, where he painted a sort of grand historical vision of a fruitful overlap rather than a clash of civilizations?
That's a very good question. I wish I was in Beijing now discussing with my colleagues and associates the maiden speech made by Carr. I think Chinese, generally speaking, are always respectful of people who look to history, who use history. The Chinese themselves allude to history continuously. So I think, generally speaking, this speech would probably have gone well down in Beijing. But, of course, this is speculation. I'm not in Beijing.
You have, though, lived and worked in China for two decades. Do the Chinese regard the Australian relationship as critical? I mean, a lot is made of our middle power status as a bridge between the US and China. But from your personal context, how is Australia regarded?
To be honest, when I moved to Sydney about 11 months ago and started to then visit China, the place I had lived, like you said, for over 20 years, I was struck by how little Australia really figures in the thinking of people dealing with foreign policy, with diplomacy, with strategic thinking. Exactly because they don't acknowledge Australia as a regional player that they need to engage with, as a country with which China would benefit from having a much broader and deeper relationship, discussing regional issues and not only bilateral issues. At the moment, Australia is really looked upon as a country which sells resources to China.
So do you think that is something that could change with the right foreign minister?
I think so, indeed. I myself have been in big support of the idea that the present vice-ministerial level strategic dialogue conducted between the two countries would be elevated to, at a minimum, a foreign minister level, but hopefully even a deputy prime minister level, so that there would be in place a regular mechanism which would facilitate much more meaningful discussions between the two countries. Also on the military side, there have been two exercises between China and Australia. One live fire exercise off the coast of Qingdao 2 years ago, and then just a few months ago, there was a disaster relief exercise in Sichuan, in which the Australian armed forces took part. But this sort of cooperation, the militaries getting to know each other, being able to converse with each other, all of this would deepen the relationship, and I think to Australia's benefit.
In what way?
The fact that you know who you're dealing with over a broad range of issues will help you when there is a crisis, when there are difficult issues to discuss, when there are those moments when you're at opposite ends of the spectrum and you need to be able to move forward and find a solution. Knowing your collaborator, your partner, your ally, in this case, of course, China is not an ally, but just the knowledge is an important tool.
You mentioned deepening the military relationship. Of course, China's military expansion in the region is an area of sensitivity for many countries, including Australia. Do you think that it is possible, it would be possible, to deepen that military connection?
I think certainly discussions between the Chinese and Australian militaries would be beneficial, if not for any other reasons, that Australia would have a better sense of China's military ambitions, plans, military spending, and so on.
Does it surprise you that Australian officials apparently have a greater concern about the threat of Chinese military aggression than their US counterparts?
This is something actually that puzzles me, and I'm not quite sure what it is based on. This impression is based on my own conversations in Washington, D.C. with people from the Pentagon, with specialists in the National Intelligence Council and so on. And then, on the other hand, conversations I've had in Canberra with a wider range of officials. I'm not quite sure what is the basis for this difference.
And who is the more realistic, the U.S. or the Australians?
In my view, I think the U.S., partly because they have such deep intelligence about China, they really do put a lot of energy, resources, effort into understanding what's going on in China. I think American analysis of China is the world's best.
And you think that Australian diplomats overplay the fear of Chinese aggression?
I think it's more a question of the unknown. Nobody knows what China is going to do with its power as it rises. Of course, that's one of the defining questions of this decade and of this century for everyone, especially those in the region. And this uncertainty, what China is going to do with its power, also evokes fears, understandable fears, and suspicions.
So what's your sense? I mean, overnight the Chinese backed a Security Council resolution on Syria, reversing the position where they vetoed previous resolutions. Do you think there is a shift in Chinese foreign policy underway as China settles into the role of major power diplomatically as well as economically?
I think China is really struggling in the role of being a major power. I think we're going to see lots of these ups and downs in China's diplomacy as China gets used to that role of being looked upon as a major power. I like to say that if if China's rise, this dramatic rise, has taken outsiders by surprise, I would say it's also taken many in China by surprise. China is not always prepared to be in the role of major power. Of course, sometimes the Chinese will have us think that they don't want to be. I think they're very much wanting to be, but they're not yet equipped with all the tools. They don't have the capacity always to be a major power.
So do you have fears about what China will do with its power as it rises?
I think fear is perhaps too strong a word. I certainly have lots of questions. I think it is a big question. It is an uncertainty what China will do with its power as it rises. So far, there has been no definite answer to the question, does a country which is an authoritarian state, which treats its citizens in a way which is unacceptable to anyone who believes in a democracy, is that same country then going to behave badly towards its neighbors or others in the region? That's a question which no one has the answer to.
Now, Linda Jacobson, you mentioned Bob Carr's support of the US alliance. Was there genuine concern amongst the Chinese about the US-Australian announcement of that deployment of an extra 2,500 US troops in Darwin last year?
I think that was overplayed by the media, both some media outlets in Australia and also in China. At the end of the day, I don't think the decision, the substantive content of that decision, upset the Chinese. The Chinese had been briefed that it was coming, and as I said, I think they saw that more as a natural evolution of the decades-long Australia-United States alliance.
Just one final question. What's your sense of the effect of that fear that countries in the region have about China on China's own military ambitions?
I think the uncertainties, the fears that China's rise is creating around its periphery will lead to countries reevaluating their own military strength to begin with, and secondly, very much looking at the United States to remain in Asia as a security guarantor, but at the same time, a security guarantor that can come to terms with China. None of the countries in the region want to see a conflict between the United States and China. But at the same time, they're very much hoping, encouraging the United States to remain very committed to security in this region.
Do you think, though, that their fears will actually fuel a greater military build-up within China?
I think China's military modernization is going to go forward according to plans which have been made already two or nearly three decades ago. As China becomes more prosperous, funds will also be allocated to the continuous modernization of China's military.
Linda Jacobson, thanks very much for speaking to us.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. It's absolutely fascinating speaking to someone who's been there for that period of